Welcome to a look back at this year's Beyond the Boardroom episodes, where we discuss shareholder activism with industry experts. It's been a packed year full of podcasts, as alongside our Beyond the Boardroom series, we've had jam-packed magazine and special report episodes, with some bonus episodes mixed in for good measure. So join me, Kieran Poole, and journey through the class of 2021. But before then, in the show description is a link to a very quick survey all about the podcast. We want to know what you have to say and if there is anything else we can do in the podcast that you'd like to hear. Maybe a topic you'd like to be discussed, or a guest you'd like to hear interviewed. It could even be you coming on. Just click on the link in the description and complete the short survey. If you can do that now or after listening to the best of, that would be fantastic. So, on with the look back now at this year's shows. Our first stop is January, when David Samra, Managing Director and Founding Partner of Artisan Partners, told us about his investment approach and what Artisan look out for.
So first, we look for a cheap price, meaning that we want to buy the shares at a price that does not properly value the company. We're getting a bargain. Second, we're looking for a high return business. We want to own good companies. We don't want to own companies just because they're statistically cheap. We want to own companies that are fundamentally undervalued, but that are good businesses. The third characteristic that we look for is a strong balance sheet. And the fourth characteristic is a management team with a track record and history of building shareholder value. So that's what we look for in a perfect world. Of course, the world is not perfect, as we all know. And though we never compromise on buying an undervalued securities, as you can imagine, the other characteristics exist in shades of gray. Some businesses are better than others. Some balance sheets are stronger than others. And some management teams are better at creating value than others.
In February, George Michael Gerstein and Sarah Krovitz of Stradley Ronan Stevens & Young focused on the Department of Labor and the Securities and Exchange Commission's stances on ESG issues. Sarah speaks first.
So global funds that hold ESG assets have surged more than 50% beyond $1.3 trillion since the end of 2019, according to the Institute of International Finance. A recent PwC study out of Europe predicted that ESG fund assets under management could account for over 50% of total European mutual fund assets by 2025. And in the US, sustainable investing assets grew 42% in the last 2 years, reaching $17.1 trillion at the start of 2020, according to the US SIF Foundation, which is a third of the $51.4 trillion professionally managed assets in the US. And the two US equity funds with the strongest returns in 2020 both focused on clean energy. So obviously, the pandemic has brought additional focus to ESG funds. At least in the early part of the year, a lot of evidence showed that ESG strategies were performing better than non-ESG strategies. And the pandemic, along with sort of this, all of the social justice issues that have happened, have really highlighted the importance of ESG to many investors as a values proposition. So I think you can see we both have value and values aligning to really increase the focus on ESG. George, what else do you think you want to add here?
Well, we're going to talk about the regulators are trying to catch up. And one of the reasons, you know, they're acting now is because of the growth Sarah just talked about, but because of there's still considerable confusion over exactly what ESG means. It is an umbrella term. It refers to many different risks and opportunities ranging from climate change and clean energy to board composition to executive compensation. It is incumbent upon investment managers to sort of drill down and understand, you know, what this means and how it's evolved. Many years ago, there was this assumption that if you were to take an ESG factor into account, you were necessarily sacrificing investment returns. It was to do good. That's changed dramatically. There is significant data now and models that identify a real nexus between an ESG factor and investment performance. In other words, and it doesn't apply to all ESG factors, but certainly some based on the current data, that ESG factors can be material in the colloquial sense, not, you know, how some law would define materiality, but certainly it's becoming more and more material. And as Sarah referenced, it's actually having an impact on investment return.
In March, David Chase Lopes, the managing director of DF King in the EMEA region, told us how activism in Europe has changed.
The first real activist situation I found myself in was in 2007 as an activist working for efficient capital structures against Vodafone. And a lot has changed, but while some things are new, some things haven't changed at all. In 2007, one was, as an activist, treated like a marauder or a locust, as the Germans like to say. Where so, I'd say in 2021, there's absolutely a great deal of interest and enthusiasm for activists. So some of the things that are new, I would say, is that if you look at Europe, there's a large number of deals. In 2020 in Europe, if one reads the Lazard report, over 60 transactions occurred despite the pandemic. It was a huge uptick from October on, but higher than the previous years. You see different types of actors from the large players such as Elliott, but also some very small ones who join the party from time to time or become activists in relation to a specific subject or situation. You have new subjects. ESG is becoming more of a subject beyond just the NGO sphere. It's interesting that it's TCI out of the United Kingdom that was driving a Say on Climate idea around asking investors to vote on their company's climate policies around ESG issues. Another thing is that at the same time, there are a lot of things that don't change about it, especially around how one reacts or the strategies that one uses. So you still find lots of situations where you have a risk for investors of real creeping control. I've seen this many times in the French market where I've done a great deal of my work. One could even say, if you read the press around Suez and Veolia, that one of the biggest risks that investors are facing at Suez is that Veolia could be engaging in creeping control. State intervention, depending on the country, still is something that is used. And the other thing ultimately is that it's still the same idea about finding a way to improve shareholder returns. It's just a question of, is your series of short-term decisions the best way to get to a long-term outcome?
In May, Gabriel Grego, Chief Investment Officer and Managing Partner of Quintessential Capital Management, joined me on the podcast. Now, I asked him about the following quote he had given us for an in-depth article. He had told our journalists, "Short selling is like a knife. You can use it to stab someone, or you can use it to perform heart surgery."
Short selling, and I'm talking about activist short selling, is a very powerful tool. It's a tool that can exert some change to the company that is being a target of this activity. Whether it's a good activity for the market, for the community, for corporate world in general, whether it's a bad activity depends on the intention and on what is the target. So if you are targeting, for example, like we try to do, like many of our colleagues try to do, target strictly unethical, fraudulent and criminal companies, which are basically ruining the party for everybody, diminishing the trust in the system, preying on the naive and the weak, then activist short selling, which is the way we do it, trying to bring transparency and accountability to what's happening, may be a very good activity, because the ultimate result is that it removes the bad apples from the basket, so these fraudulent companies, and it creates a deterrent for other companies not to engage in the same path. So it can be a very good activity. On the other hand, there are some people that use activist short selling in an unethical way, where they're targeting companies which are not necessarily criminal or fraudulent, and they, you know, they try to damage them for the short term just to make a quick buck. And obviously, these people make a great disservice to our profession. So that's the same way. You can use a knife to perform heart surgery, life-saving heart surgery, or you can use it to stab somebody. We like to think that we try to be like heart surgeons.
In July, Tracy Gopal, the founder and CEO of Third Arrow Strategies, discussed the Third Arrow Strategies Japan Board Diversity Network.
Well, I started the network because I saw a market need to increase the number of women on boards in Japan. I believe that board gender diversity is crucial for Japan's economic success. I mean, we know that getting women and minority on boards has become a global topic. And globally, there's been an acceptance that board diversity is a key part of corporate governance, tied to improved performance, greater innovation, lower risk, and quite important for Japan, acquisition and retention of talent. And, you know, I noticed how many organizations there were focused on this issue in the United States. And I wanted to create a global movement for Japan by bringing together current and aspiring board directors, academic, corporate and nonprofit leaders to drive impact in Japan. I mean, for more background, you know, I've been passionate about Japan for 3 decades and I speak Japanese. And I believe as a non-Japanese, I can bring foreign perspective and really make a difference in this country that I truly care about.
And what do you hope to achieve?
Well, my goals are at the individual level, the organizational level, as well as the country level. On an individual level, I want to support the current female board directors through providing global forums for exchange of best practices, not only in how they can promote diversity on their boards, but also in areas of ESG, risk management, and workforce retention. I also am supporting the pipeline of women who are either board ready or who can be board ready in a few years. At the organizational level, I want to support the companies through helping them identify talented candidates, understanding the skills needed for their boards, and also support them in investing in their female talent by offering their female leadership the opportunity to join a global network and receive the training they need. I've seen reports in various media where companies truly want to support these women, they just don't necessarily know how, and I want to be part of that solution. And in the end, I mean, I hope to play a significant role in not only increasing the number of women on boards, but also in the excellence of these women on boards. I would like the view to shift in the company boardroom from, oh, we need to add a woman on board to appease our investor pressure, to, wow, we really need to identify strong female talent to really elevate our organization and compete in this global environment. I mean, in the end, I mean, this is all about economic prosperity for Japan. My organization is named Third Arrow Strategies after former Prime Minister Abe's Third Arrow for Economic Revitalization. And I just simply hope to achieve this through promoting governance, investor engagement, as well as womenomics issues.
And of course, throughout the year, we had numerous special reports. And to discuss those, we had representatives from the company sponsoring them. So in April, as part of our Europe report, Tom Matthews, a partner at White & Case and head of its global shareholder activism practice, joined me alongside Edward Bridges, a senior managing director at FTI Consulting and head of its UK activism practice. Tom told us about how COVID-19 impacted activism and his law firm.
Well, I obviously agree that the number of public campaigns dropped significantly in Q2 and Q3 last year as the pandemic hit. But our experience was that there was still lots going on beneath the surface. And in fact, our activism practice had its busiest year last year. I think many people started this year with an expectation that levels of activism would be high for various reasons. And while we're still seeing a lot of inbound inquiries on potential situations and doing a lot of prep work, that hasn't yet translated into a significant number of publicly observable campaigns this year. And my sense is that that is reflective of the wider market at the moment. One possible reason for the lower volume so far this year might be that activist focus has been distracted by SPACs. More on that a bit later. Another might be that with the pandemic still heavily impacting a number of businesses, activists aren't quite ready yet to make a public move. Either way, for various reasons, we expect that levels of activism will bounce back over the course of the rest of this year. And one big driver of this is likely to be the return of the M&A markets.
Then Edward discussed diversity.
there may be something about a business where poor diversity inclusion is creating an impediment to the progress of the business. I'll give you a very good example. I won't use names here, but we had an activist, ESG activist, come in who was talking about a case study, a listed car servicing business in the States, where the management team was suffering from two things. One was a shortage of mechanics, and two was spiraling wage costs. And of course, the ESG activist comes in and says, well, one of the reasons that this is happening is because you're choosing to shut out half the population, the working population, from jobs within your business, namely women. There were two things that I think that were implemented there. One was to make the working environment more conducive to women. As you probably aware, auto workshops can be pretty male-dominated environments. And the second thing was to set up training programs so that you had a pipeline of female mechanics who were coming through and onto the shop floor. Now, two things come out of that. One, over a longer period of time, you relieve that tension, that pricing tension around the workforce by simply making jobs available to the entire population, the workforce, male and female. The second thing, of course, is that customer satisfaction went through the roof because, you know, there is a traditional, and it's not a joke, but there's a traditional tension between female drivers and mechanics at the point at which you want your car service. And of course, female mechanics dealing with female drivers and owners of cars is a much possibly, I won't say it is, but it's possibly a better customer service experience. So everyone wins in that situation, but it was a very obvious problem with the business that had a very obvious but not particularly comfortable solution. Now, that's now been put in place, and of course, the business is thriving. You know, again, an ESG activist who's targeting an oil and gas firm may be much more aggressive, particularly if they feel that that company's business model is in jeopardy in the short term as a consequence of, let's say, its environmental performance. But that activist can also come in the form of an NGO who, frankly, has no value proposition to offer, but is simply trying to push their own agenda in terms of potentially the environment or the social element or sustainability element of a business.
In June, as part of our Canada report, John Feldman, a partner at Goodman's, joined me alongside Ian Robertson, President of the Canada Region and Executive Vice President of Communication Strategy at Kingsdale Advisors. I asked John about how boards have used takeover rules to thwart activists.
The takeover bid rules, at least the new ones, came into effect in 2016. There's been takeover bid rules around forever, but these new rules have been put into place to give boards a bit more time to deal with hostile bids and hostile attacks on the companies. It's been used very rarely to date, although last year we were involved in a contest where we did exactly that. It was one of those activist situations where the CEO got fired for cause, was being sued, and wanted, by way of a proxy fight, to effectively get his job back. And as a founder of this company, he did have some support. It wasn't clear that he would or wouldn't win the fight, but what the board was very certain about was if this particular activist got his hands on the company, it would be bad for shareholders. So with COVID in place, there was an ability, as we just talked about, to postpone the meeting. So the shareholder meeting was postponed until the fall, and this fight was happening in the summer. And so what we decided to do was hire an investment bank to see if there was a way to sell the company to provide a value-enhancing transaction to unitholders and effectively avoid the proxy fight altogether. So what we did is we hired an investment bank. And rather than structuring a potential deal as a typical plan of arrangement, sort of one-step merger type transaction, instead what we did is we structured it as a friendly takeover bid. And the reason that's relevant is because under the new takeover bid rules, a takeover bid that complies has to be open for 105 days. The one exception to that, if the board agrees to reduce the time, then it can do that, but then it means that other bids also get a reduced time. So what happened was, is the board entered into a support agreement, which was a deal that it would support a friendly takeover bid and require that the bid only be open for only 35 days, plus some back-end time that is required to deal with some coercion issues that aren't relevant. But what they ended up doing was they signed a deal, announced the deal, got the takeover bid done before the meeting for the proxy fight was ever going to happen. All the shareholders loved the deal. It was a massive premium to where the stock had been trading for years. And eventually the activists gave up and basically tendered their own shares to the deal. So it was a pretty fun way to use the takeover bid rules to thwart a proxy contest.
Whereas Ian told us what he thinks is behind the rise of hostile and contested M&A in the country.
Well, it's a free option with enough examples now that shows it works. So, you know, why not? If you couple this with the fact that since 2017, ISS and Glass Lewis for Canadian deals have doubled the number of against recommendations they've had, it says to shareholders, you know, what's the worst that can happen? We still have the same deal that was on the table before we opposed it. So we have seen an increase in Canada over the last few years. You know, if I cite the time period between, let's say, 2018 and 2020, we saw a total of 15 deals opposed, with 8 last year, 6 in 2019, and only 1 in 2018. So you see a ramp up of these deals being opposed more. And it's now common that anything that isn't labeled best and final is going to be met with skepticism from your shareholders. Activists specifically, but also I would say large shareholders now have become in tune to the fact that there's probably going to be at least some wiggle room left on the table to increase a bid, unless there's a very clear indication from the bidder that that's not the case. So really what we're seeing is that the launch of a transaction circular increasingly kicks off a game of brinksmanship between the issuer and at least one of its shareholders to see if there's a better deal that can be had and at what cost.
It's worth noting as well that since recording, Ian Robertson is now the CEO of Kingsdale Advisors. Then in June, as part of our ESG report, Gabrielle Wolf, a director in the proxy solicitation group at Innisfree M&A Incorporated, came on the podcast alongside her colleague Craig Pays, an investor engagement manager. I asked Gabrielle what argument she found resonated when working for Engine Number One in its hugely successful proxy contest at ExxonMobil.
I think the key here, and what I think a lot of writers have gotten wrong, is that all of the arguments that resonated were really integrally related to value destruction. It wasn't just an ESG story that Engine Number One was telling to institutional investors that was convincing, but really the ESG story about profits. Exxon lost more than $20 billion in 2020. They suffered a credit rating downgrade. They are at risk of having to borrow billions just to pay their dividend, and their share price over the past decade has produced a negative 30% return. And they were removed from the Dow Jones Industrial Average. So Engine Number One made environmental arguments, but they were integrally related to Exxon's fiscal bottom line and the ability for Exxon to survive the energy transition. China has made a pledge to be net zero by 2060. Ford is no longer going to be producing combustion engine cars by 2035. And Engine Number One was really making arguments about the energy transition and how Exxon needs to diversify away from being an oil and gas company to being an energy company in order to survive the lower long-term demand scenarios that are going to arise as a result of lots of changes in our economy. Engine really demonstrated that ESG grievances drove share price declines, and I think that was what was key to winning the proxy contest. Now, I think one other really important component of this is that Engine pointed out that Exxon's existing board had only one independent member other than the CEO, who was appointed only earlier this year, right after the proxy contest was started, with experience at an energy company, and none of their directors had climate expertise to help the company adapt to the energy transition. And I think that was also really persuasive to institutional investors. The last piece of this, I think, is that Exxon was doing too little too late. There were reports that they had been ignoring shareholders for years. They only added 3 new directors, one with energy experience, after discussions with D.E. Shaw in the beginning of 2021, after the proxy contest was already launched, and promised to add 2 new directors with energy and climate experience over the next 12 months on the Sunday before the vote. they even went so far as to have an unscheduled hour-long pause during their virtual annual meeting, during which they were reportedly telephoning shareholders to ask them to reconsider their votes and flip votes from the dissident slate to Exxon slate. And these are things that shareholders could see through, especially long-term investors who were the ones who supported Engine slate and were the biggest influence on Engine winning the proxy contest. And those are three of the four biggest pension funds in America, CalPERS, CalSTRS, and the New York State Common Retirement Fund, and the three largest index funds, Vanguard, BlackRock, and State Street, which collectively owns 1/5 of all Exxon stock.
I think Gabby just highlighted a great example of ESG activism really resonating. But I would say just last month, we saw the Tegna proxy contest against Standard General. And that felt like a contest where ESG just didn't seem to resonate. Part of that was the company's stock had performed incredibly well in 2020 in a very challenging year. And so it didn't seem as if Standard General's attacks were making a lot of traction. And so what we saw was, without, you know, financial and operational performance attacks, we saw Standard General initiate attacks around diversity, equity, and inclusion initiatives at Tegna. The primary incident cited by Standard General was essentially a Standard General nominee who withdrew during the campaign for conflict reasons. And Standard General went on to extend this specific incident to wider themes around DE&I. In this contest in particular, we saw, you know, a significant level of diversity-themed attacks in a way we really hadn't before. But kind of echoing what Gabby said, I think this is another case where shareholders saw through it. It didn't seem like this line of attack was that convincing to a lot of the major shareholders. Shareholders recognized that Tegna already had a number of existing commitments to DE&I, a track record of integrating DE&I initiatives into its business, into the board, into its workforce. And so we saw in this contest a number of key shareholders expressing their skepticism around dissidents' attempts here to bring up DE&I. Again, keeping in mind that this was a time when DE&I was an active priority for the company. And not only was there shareholder skepticism, we also saw the proxy advisory firms agree that Tegna had already taken appropriate action when it came to DE&I issues. You know, ISS saying that the board was not caught flat-footed here or being reactive. The company had, you know, last year in September had already hired a chief diversity officer. The company had written committee charters to include diversity oversight responsibility. So they had taken massive action ahead of this contest and before Standard General really brought up these attack lines. And Tegna ultimately won one of the first proxy contests based largely on DE&I issues.
Plus, on that same episode, we heard from Elizabeth Gonzalez-Sussman, a member of the Corporate Securities Law Group, an activist and equity investment practice at Olshan, Froom, Woloski. She gave us the advice she would give an activist looking to launch an ESG campaign.
So I think it still comes down to the same elements that have been part of an activist campaign for decades now. You do need to have the financial argument that if you don't focus on these objectives, it's going to affect a company's bottom line. Or if a company is undervalued, you want to demonstrate that these are some of the issues that have been plaguing the company. So, you know, again, financial argument is change warranted. Has the company been asleep at the wheel? Has the board lacked the skill set needed to unlock value? And are some of these ESG elements a driver of unlocking that value? And I think that, you know, if you can establish that, like any campaign, that's critical. That's point number one. And then the second part is, if you are going to nominate directors in your activist campaign, whether it's ESG focused or not, you're going to want to have the right kind of nominees. And those nominees are going to have critical skill sets to address, you know, the number of issues that are plaguing the company. And if they're ESG related, you're going to need candidates that have backgrounds that are going, you know, to address the issues that you are identifying. And as with all activist campaigns, you establish change is warranted, and then you establish that your nominees are going to be the better change agents and the better catalysts to address these important issues. So I think both of those elements are critical to launching an ESG campaign. And the final thing I'll say is, obviously, you need to know your shareholder base. And you need to make sure that shareholders are going to be aligned in what you believe. You know, looking at your shareholder base, talking with the shareholders are going to be important. Obviously, we have a lot of large institutional holders at each public company, and they have put out voting policies. So you kind of already have an idea of whether or not they're going to support what you're saying, or whether the nominees that you've picked are the nominees that these institutions are going to support. And so, you know, that is also a very critical element before you launch anything, is understanding whether or not you're going to get that shareholder support and what you're saying.
Next, in July, as part of our half-year review, Andrew Friedman, a partner at Ocean Freem Woloski and co-chair of its shareholder activism group, told us about how 6 months of change at the SEC affects activism.
Anytime you have a new guard come in at the SEC, we're always wary of what changes may be coming. So far, the news seems mostly positive for activists. We welcome the universal proxy rule coming back onto the table, and we'll see where that goes. You know, one of the recent developments, which isn't so welcoming, is the SEC's potential focus on shortening the 13D 10-day window. My view is, if a regime or set of rules hasn't shown itself to be broken, then there's no need to fix it. And to me, any steps the SEC takes that could disincentivize shareholder activists, it would be a disservice to investors at large and also to public companies. So, you know, we'll have to see where this goes with the potential shortening of the 13D 10-day window. But again, I don't think there is justification at this point that demonstrates how investors are harmed by activists having 10 calendar days to file their 13Ds. And I don't believe we've seen any attendant harm in the form of activists building creeping control type positions in those 10 calendar days. And also to say, there's several other defenses that companies have, whether it be under state laws like Delaware Section 203 with its 15% threshold. Many companies, as we saw in 2020, have adopted poison pills that would also cap an activist at a certain percentage ownership. So if the idea is to, the concern is around preventing an activist from acquiring some form of creeping control during the 10-day window, then you know, I think it's already being addressed by several other rules and laws. You know, again, we'll see where it goes, but you know, I'd caution the SEC about enacting rules that could disincentivize activists from playing the important role that they play at public companies. As far as the proxy advisory rules, I think it was welcome development to see those being taken off the table, as I believe they have been. And, you know, we'll just have to wait and see. The SEC's got a lot on its plate these days, and I'm sure it's got a, you know, full agenda, and we'll have to see where its focus lies as it relates to shareholder activism. You know, they definitely have their hands full, so it'll be exciting to see where things shake up.
In September, as part of our M&A activism report, Patrick Gadson and Lawrence Elbum, co-heads of the shareholder activism practice at Vincent and Elkins, joined us together to discuss whether we are indeed in a golden age of anti-deal activism. Lawrence speaks first.
If you use the past several months to predict the future, it would be safe to say we're in a bit of a golden age here. agitators are going to be plenty in an environment that has fully valued companies seeking M&A and getting premiums that are 20% premiums or below, sometimes in the teens, sometimes in the single digits. It's an equity deal. And the activism community is seeing that there's, you know, a pretty quick way for the boards and the acquirers to renegotiate those deals to save face and give more to the shareholders. And I think that, you know, so long as the agitators are having success with this model, we're going to see it more often. Like Patrick said, companies should be bracing for this by having a real good sense of what the market would pay for their companies at any given time, stress testing their plan against that market check valuation on an ongoing basis, and in an intellectually honest fashion, evaluating, you know, which pathway is best. It is very easy for investors reading a proxy statement, playing Monday morning quarterback, to pick apart a process. There's no such thing as a cookie cutter perfect process for M&A. Sometimes one buyer comes along and it seems like a perfect deal with a great premium and it sails through, and other times a deal like that gets tanked. I think that boards, you know, are well served to prepare for this golden age by thinking very carefully about the governance process they have in place to review inbound offers, to consider multiple offers, and make sure that they create a bespoke process that's procedurally and substantively fair so that it's more defensible in the proxy statements that they have to file.
The only thing I'll add to that is, because Lawrence says everything you just said is totally correct, there is sort of a difference between contested M&A and anti-deal M&A. And so, you know, if you look at it through a historical lens when thinking about, are we in the golden age, right? Anti-deal M&A used to be a shareholder or a potential acquirer would surface in, you know, 1980, whatever, right? And say, no, I'll buy it for more. And then someone else would surface and say, no, I'll pay more, right? And then there'd be this sort of very public, acrimonious back and forth among several potential acquirers after a deal was announced, right? So your typical, you know, Gordon Gekko Wall Street stuff. That has changed in that, you know, now anti-deal M&A, it doesn't necessarily involve a potential acquirer who says, I'll offer a better deal. I'll offer sweeter terms. It could just be someone who's been in your shareholder base for a very long time who says, yeah, I don't like this deal. They didn't pay enough. We deserve richer terms. I'm going to champion voting against this deal with no necessary alternative on the table, right? That is the sort of slight evolutionary difference between, you know, the golden age of what we'll call anti-deal activity, you know, in the roaring 80s and our current sort of anti-deal golden age we're in now, right? There could be an argument that there is more sort of quote unquote anti-deal in terms of just attacking an announced deal and announcing that you offer, you know, superior terms. Maybe more of that happened in prior, you know, generations, but it's a very different time now. And I certainly agree with everything Lawrence said in that the period we are in now, having shareholders who just may not like a deal vocally express how much they don't like a deal, actually not serve up any alternatives. We're definitely, I think, in the golden age of that.
Also on that episode was Michael Verrecchia, Managing Director of the M&A and Activism Advisory Group at Morrow Sodali, who told us what a company can do when an activist pushing for a sale launches a proxy fight.
If you're talking about an activist who launches a proxy contest to oppose the deal, even if we're unopposed, you're already in a position where you're going to speak to all your top holders and the advisory firm. So if there's actually a formal contest against the deal, it basically takes that engagement and puts it into overdrive. I mean, you're still talking about the rationale for the deal and again, how we got to this place where this, you know, this is now in front of shareholders. But, you know, obviously you'll be answering a lot of criticisms that the shareholder puts forward. And so I think you just need to be prepared to have the conversations with all different constituencies within the profile and hear their concerns and ultimately look for support. You know, activists sometimes look at it as a two-prong approach, right? You know, not only do we want to block the deal, but then, you know, the second stage of this will be a proxy contest for board seats. You know, if shareholders don't like the deal, you know, and they want to vote it down, you know, possible next step is to, you know, get shareholders' voices in the boardroom try to get a better deal done. So it really just kind of depends on, the form that this takes, but, being prepared to talk about the deal, hear shareholders' concerns and address them is the best thing you can do.
In October, for the proxy voting annual review, Kylie Kaffet and Derek Zaber, partners at Sidley Austin and co-chairs of its shareholder activism practice, joined us. Here is Derek telling us about red flags activists will watch out for in shareholder voting results.
In some cases, the votes don't adequately represent an underlying concern for the leadership of the board or the size of the compensation. So you see a number of votes that come in against directors that are related to some policy that either ISS or some of the institutional investors have that really are a vote against the policy and not the individual director. So there's certainly a risk in these types of situations that the activist overplays the import of these votes, but they certainly will use these low votes as something to look out for and something to give a very, very preliminary assessment of whether the company is vulnerable. The place where I believe this is evolving goes back to what Kai said about ExxonMobil and the ESG movement, which is environmental proposals have gotten much more support over the last year. So you've seen a number of shareholders change their positions on voting for these proposals. And when those proposals get 30, 40% a substantive minority, there is an indication that the shareholders would want the company to take some action to be responsive to the concerns underlying that post. And as I think as you see more and more of the ESG either campaigns or ESG issues being integrated into other campaigns, you'll see these, lack of responsiveness to these environmental proposals that have gotten a substantial support as another issue that activists are looking at and then activists will raise in their critiques.
And now let's listen to Kai explore how activists use precatory proposals to further their aims.
The reason why economic activists rarely use this mechanism is, number one, Rule 14a8 proposals don't allow to nominate directors. Number two, there's a minimum holding period that oftentimes activists don't meet because they own the stock for less than 1 year pre-campaign. And three, while it is financially attractive to be included in the proxy materials of the company, it is also limiting because there's only a certain word count that an activist is allowed to have, and the company has the ability to rebut the activist's arguments in the proxy statement on the spot. Moreover, activists typically like to control the filing timing of a proxy material. So, long way of saying that we don't expect to see Rule 14a8 proposals to be used by activists focused on economic outcomes all that often. Having said that, it is a very cost-efficient mechanism to use. So it is conceivable that activists, particularly in multi-year campaigns, where they want to push only for a small measure of additional change as opposed to wholesale change, they may lob in a proposal like that from time to time. But we still expect this to be the rare exception to the rule.
So I'm sure you agree that was a lot of content. It's worth noting as well that in August I was joined by my editorial colleagues to count down the top 10 wildest campaigns of the year. That episode was well worth a listen. Plus, if you didn't know, last month we teamed up again with Command Financial to produce its Corporate Compliance Roundtable. Every year since 2015, we have gathered industry experts at the Yale Club in New York, but once again, we had to go virtual due to the COVID-19 pandemic. So for that, panels of inside and outside counsel debated various trends in shareholder activism from this year. So all that remains for me to say is thank you for listening, not just to this episode, but all of our previous episodes. And if you can fill out the quick survey in the show description by clicking the link, that would be really appreciated. Thank you for being part of the show, and for those who celebrate it, have a very Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year from all of us at Incitia. See you in 2022.